Hello, welcome back to Making It Real, a podcast by TKS that follows our alumni all around the world. I'm your host, Isabella, from the 2018 Toronto cohort, and I am so excited to share these conversations, the insights, the tech, the problems that we talk about. So without further ado, let's go make it real.
Yay, hello. Okay, so here I'm with one of my favorite people, Cassia. Cassia and I met years and years ago, and I think we first bonded over, I remember you wearing overalls and like a stripy shirt, so we think we first bonded over vibes, and then it turns out we have very similar interests, very similar ambitions, including one day we're going to own the world's best bakery, experiential dining, you know, vibe. So super excited, because Cassia, above, you know, being an amazing, authentic, cool person, is also up to a bunch of really interesting stuff. She's a sustainability student at McGill. Last year, she worked at Pila, which is a compost company. They have a couple of interesting products, but they're also famous for their phone cases. And now, Cassia works at one of the UN's food agencies, which she'll tell you a lot about later. Anyway, so excited, Cassia. How are you doing? Anything you want to add about yourself to begin?
Oh, I'm doing good. I think you covered it. That's me.
That's you. Okay, well, we can just dig in. What is the mindset you're using recently and why?
I think it's consistency over intensity right now. I think there was a while where growth mindset for me got like a little bit toxic, like as a simple example, making decisions for food or anything like that. Like, oh, should I eat this cupcake or make like the healthy decision? I'm trying to improve as a person. Those small decisions can quickly spiral and take a toll on your mental health. But if you focus more on long-term, just like doing things slowly, like reading a little bit every day instead of, I'm going to read two books today, I find has benefited my mental health and allowed me to actually grow faster in the long term.
I think that's really cool too, because you can't just look at it from, oh, this food is healthy or unhealthy. Because your personality, like food and food review culture, is very much part of it. Appreciating the art of food for more than just the nutrition. If you didn't know, Cassia is a level 7 Google reviewer, and she's very so diligent. I am too. She's my only ally in this journey. And it's a very specific, but no, Cassia is much more popular than me. She has like 150 people who actively follow her reviews. And I think it's important to acknowledge that you eating a piece of food and enjoying like the culture and the scenery around it also develops your own authentic person. It's not just about if it's healthy or not.
Yeah. And there's another side to that, because I'm also very passionate about nutrition. Like I spend over an hour a day listening to nutrition podcasts on average. So it's, I really like food for the art of it and like the taste of it. But then I'm also like genuinely really passionate about nutrition. That's a side note.
No, that's good. What are the podcasts?
I mean, number one, super basic, Huberman Lab. The Huberman Lab podcast it's elite. Like, it's not overhyped. Everybody who's into health listens to it, but it's really, really good. Rhonda Patrick is another, she has a great podcast, Dr. Rhonda Patrick. Yeah.
And you've been into health for a really long time. Like, you're the healthiest person I know. I think, like, holistically, you're not just, like, intense working out, whatever. You are food and the way you feel and the way you exercise, and I think that's a big part of your personality.
Wow. Well, high praise. Thank you. Yeah.
So what about, so consistency over intensity, how does that relate to your work at the UN? And tell us a little bit more about that.
So I'm working for IFAD, the International Fund for Agricultural Development, which is a UN agency focused specifically on rural people, lifting rural people out of poverty through agricultural interventions. So the poorest people in the world largely are people engaging in rural agriculture. And so IFAD focuses on agricultural interventions to allow them to feed themselves. And then they can donate elsewhere as well. And then going forward, it's like, okay, 340 million is assumed. Are we going to do a little bit more, a little bit less? It's not like this year, given our priorities, how much do we have to donate? It's like, just assuming the same amount, which I find from a government standpoint very interesting. I feel like ideally our governments would be reassessing their priorities more deeply than that, than just being like, Okay, that's what we gave last time. I'm assuming we're prioritizing the same things, but that's not how it works. I mean, in this case, I'm kind of okay with it because I think EFAT is genuinely doing really great work and it's a super impactful organization for our government to be funding. But knowing that they approach everything this way, like, oh, okay, we spent this much on healthcare last year, a little bit more, a little bit less, as opposed to being like, okay, how much do we actually need? Like, what's changed? Just went through a pandemic. Like, you know, like, let's look at the cost structures, especially because everybody just spends their budget based on what they're given. And then the budget then is reallocated accordingly. So anyways, that was not that related to consistency over intensity, but
it's part of what you've been learning and it sparked the thought. Okay, two follow-ups. One, did you know ArriveCan cost north of $50 million to produce?
I did not know that.
Isn't that like the least lean allocation of funds? Like, can you imagine if you gave $50 million to someone who's like a glucose ring, like what Ben is doing, or, you know, literally like any cool invasive technology that's not like a basic app?
Okay, honestly, from being in intergovernmental organizations, which based on meetings, I think operates culturally very similar to government and other NGOs. Like, that doesn't even surprise me because it's a deep-rooted culture of inefficiency. It's like seven people on a meeting to choose the sandwiches at an event. Not an exaggeration. So I think like there's just that deep-rooted culture of inefficiency and you're paying people for those hours in meetings. And yeah, I'm honestly not that surprised because that's kind of how they go.
So then do you have faith in Canada as an entity to be like a big player in the world, change a lot of things globally?
That's interesting. I don't think we've ever really wanted to be that. Like, you look at Americans and so much of their patriotism comes from like, we are a force in the world. And for Canada, we seem to be more like, we always want to do the right thing, but we want to be a helping hand, you know, like we're here to chill. as long as we're morally sound and everybody's like pretty much okay, like whatever. Like you even look at how engaged Canadians are in Canadian politics versus how engaged Canadians are in American politics. It's like, we don't know anything about our own government and we care so much about what's happening to the South. Like, we don't seem to have that drive to be a force of nature in the world. And without it, I don't think we will be. I don't know if that's necessarily a bad thing. Like, I don't know if the world needs another country that's really wanting to like step up and shape everything. So it might be more meaningful if we're just kind of a diplomatic power that wants to play a helping hand by being a large contributor to UN agencies or other meaningful projects. Yeah.
I don't know. Do you think climate's an exception?
It could be. We're not currently leading the climate game. A lot of Europe is in terms of their commitments, their international work. But behind the scenes, actually, I think Canada cares more about climate than people think. Climate and gender are Canada's two top international development priorities. And I've seen some of the negotiations for the replenishment to EFAD, and Canada's super committed to climate. And especially what I love to hear is they're very committed to climate adaptation as opposed to mitigation, which I know a lot of people would be like, what do you mean? We have to lower the amount of greenhouse gases. And it's like, yeah, okay, I agree. Mitigation is important, but adaptation being how people can survive in the face of changes to the climate, I think is especially for young people, like underlooked at. For the generation above us, they're paying a good amount of attention. But like, if we cannot grow crops when floods come, when droughts come, when it's warmer, when storms come, we're screwed. So Canada is very committed to climate adaptation, which is really great to hear. So more is going on behind the scenes than I think people think. But to answer your question, yes, I think it could be an exception in terms of stepping up to be a large global role model for climate. I don't think Canada's on that path though, but.
Interesting. I guess I don't even know what that looks like because from what I understand, Canada was very aggressive in the Paris Climate Accord. In 2019, Trudeau really emphasized increasing the aggressiveness of the targets. Canada's not on route to achieve those, but that was his whole thing. Actually, have you seen the Hasan Minhaj interview with Trudeau?
No.
It is so good. He's roasting him. It's from 2019, but it is still, like, I watched it this morning, actually. It was like one of the best interviews I've seen. And the reason I watched it is because 3 weeks ago, he did one with Obama.
And yeah, I saw that.
Have you seen that one?
I didn't see it, but I saw that he did it.
So good. He's so, like, he doesn't care about what they think. He's not, like, being polite. Okay, on this note, Trudeau, a couple of years ago, refunded the pipeline that went from the Alberta tar sands to Burnaby. And part of his whole thing was, we're going to have to take that energy out because we're a cold country. Please do not put Canadians under cold conditions. You don't have heating. Like, this is a really, it's a way bigger problem than if the states don't have heating, right? And his whole thing was he lifted 2% of the population out of poverty, et cetera. And instead of using truck transport, they built a pipeline with the whole intention of, we're going to donate every single one of those profits to green energy solutions. I think young people sometimes have a problem taking a little bit of debt to eventually have credit, taking that climate debt to reinvest it into technologies that don't exist. Do you think there's examples of that happening right now? Or does that, like, just kind of image of debt to credit strike you with anything that you're doing at EFAD?
I think a lot of it is more for young people, and the perception of it is less about, like, the debt to credit image, and it's just the image of the thing itself. Like, I don't think when people demonize things like pipelines, I don't think they're thinking as far as debt to credit, like, will this pay off in the long run? I think it's the image of a pipeline and that being connected to the oil industry in general, and then writing it off right there. And I think another example of that in, like, in the field that I'm working in like agricultural development, for example, fertilizers are absolutely necessary to increase agricultural productivity. Fertilizers at a large scale, especially if you're into anything environmental, largely demonized. Over applying fertilizers is a very large environmental issue in a lot of places. The agricultural runoff causes eutrophication in bodies of water, causes dead zones in bodies of water. It is a big area in issues where they're over applying fertilizers. So in a lot of North America and China, it's an issue. We need to be applying less fertilizer. But I've been looking into this, and even there was a UN recommendation calling for a global reduction in fertilizer use for environmental reasons. And I think that's a super large oversimplification because it's a dramatization of something that people have just attributed to being bad. If we want to increase agricultural productivity in areas where yields are lower, we have to increase fertilizer use. Like, that's absolutely essential. And if we increase yields in an area, so if we increase the amount of product grown in a given area, that means we use less land to grow that food. So that means less deforestation. So if we can increase yields, the environmental footprint is significantly lower. And in places like sub-Saharan Africa, some areas of Asia, South America, the fertilizer application rates are so, so, so minimal. And if we can get fertilizer to these people, their yields will increase drastically. Deforestation will decrease drastically. And the soil quality will actually improve because there are so few nutrients in the soil because they've been planting on that land for so long. So I think some things with optics, just the same as people demonizing a pipeline because it's connected to the oil industry, are the same as people demonizing fertilizer because it's connected to marine distress and environments. And people are very quick to make judgments based on one word. You hear pipeline, you hear bad. You hear fertilizer, for a lot of people, you hear bad. Whereas if you look a level deeper, these things are super important. This is a bit of a side tangent, but I think people are very, very quick to demonize the oil industry as a whole or the mining industry as a whole. And yes, they have these industries have terrible, terrible consequences. And in some cases, I will say the oil industry has been shitty. Like the time that Exxon hid the crater that killed the dinosaurs. They literally discovered that. Okay, do you know this?
No. What is this?
Okay, Exxon in, I want to say the 90s, but that could be way off. It could have been early 2000s. I think it was early 2000s. They were in the Gulf of Mexico looking for places to dig for oil. And at this time, like, what killed the dinosaurs was very, like, a mystery, you know? It's like, oh, it could have been an asteroid, could have been a volcano, like, we don't know. And then Exxon, the scientists, were looking for a place to drill for oil, and they found a mysteriously sized crater that was big enough to have been an asteroid that would have killed the dinosaurs. And the scientists came back to Exxon, and they were like, y'all, look what we found. Like, it's a crater that could have killed the dinosaurs. And Exxon was like, tell no one. Like, we want to drill oil here. You don't tell anybody about this crater. And then the scientists went rogue and went to this conference and presented the crater, and Exxon, like, got mad at them, whatever. So the scientists, like, did the right thing. Like, really, Exxon, you're going to hide, like, a massive scientific discovery because you want to drill some oil? But I don't think it is productive to just call them the enemy of the world and say that they're responsible for solving climate change and just continually demonizing them based on anything that they do. So that's one level of it. I don't think that's productive at all. Another level of it is like, are you telling me that you don't want oil? Or are you telling me that you don't want mining? Like, we need, at the very least from the oil industry, we need plastics. Like, the medical industry would collapse if we didn't have oil to make single-use plastics. Like, billions of people would suffer from lack of medical services.
Yeah, medically.
If we didn't have single-use plastics, which are from the oil industry, because that's how plastics are made. And so I think all of these things are very much oversimplified. So I don't think people are even looking as far as this debt to credit kind of situation, and they're just demonizing something right off the bat.
I think that's an amazing example, set of examples. And if I was to if I were to summarize it, it would be first and second order thinking. Everyone's tweeting about how, you know, mining sucks from their iPhone that is the product of mining in like 40 different countries. Or like when people are slandering capitalism from Instagram. And I'm like, do you understand the reason you have Instagram, or the reason Steve Jobs made the iPhone, or the reason air conditioning exists? There's incentives that align people to take big risks. And there's a big reward for doing that. I just think it's hypocritical. But love the examples you set. One last question about EFAD before we move on. You've told me several fun facts that you've learned about the organization. And I'm curious, do you want to share one or two kind of insider looks or things that you were really surprised about working at an intergovernment level?
Yeah, the first is, I mean, a little fun fact is that any handshake that you see between like any world leaders or in any sort of diplomacy situation is not random. That is like seriously thought out and agreed upon beforehand, because handshakes are one of those things that are just super formal. Everything in this environment is way more formal than you would expect it to be. Like, you can't just go and do anything. There are super signs, people on board agreeing with it, a whole team behind it. So if you ever see a picture of a handshake, they didn't just shake hands. Like, there were teams of people agreeing to do this handshake. They can shake hands if they run into each other, but it can't be photographed and it can't be publicized, any of that. So I think everything is just way more formal than you think it is in this world, like everything. So that's been interesting. Another thing is people in international men get paid so poorly, but still there is a line of people out the door applying for these jobs. On one hand, I think that is quite optimistic, because there's such a desire to have a meaningful career and an impact in the world that people are willing to do this for so little. But on the other hand, I think it also kind of shows the power of a brand and the power of ego when it comes to these things. Like, the UN has a very strong brand, and you tell your great aunt that you're working for the UN, like, she's going to know what that is. And so, like, the fact that people are willing to do this for so little pay, I think just kind of comes down to the ego and brand aspect, where if you're like, hey, great aunt, I'm working for the Rockefeller Foundation, which, like, in my mind, is the world owes a great debt to the Rockefeller Foundation, and they've done a lot of really great stuff. Nobody knows who that is. Like, nobody cares. So I think there's a large ego element to it as well. Yeah.
Love that. Actually, it reminds me of something that's kind of in the middle. But there was a famous handshake that Princess Diana did, where she shook two patients. And then the last one was, I think it was an AIDS patient or an HIV patient. And it was like, it was like she didn't have a hesitation. I mean, maybe a little bit, but it was like shake, shake, shake. And it changed the way the world saw HIV/AIDS. We're so far from that, but it's still, I think, really important to understand those like monumental moments. Like, I think Princess Diana died at least when we were, before we were born or when we were really young. But even just to like watch that and understand that history, it just, it makes me feel optimistic for the world. Like, that was only a couple of decades ago. And here we are, we're like cracking a lot. Like, there's like a new tuberculosis. I know it's not the same as AIDS, but there's like a new tuberculosis vaccine on the rise. Like, we are so much further than like shaking hands with these patients or whatever it is. Yeah.
And Johnson & Johnson might forgo the patent.
For low and middle income countries, which I think is like the perfect scenario.
Yeah, I agree. I agree.
I'm so by it. I even think this should happen more often because the companies like Advil, they take the risk to develop the like amazing drug that Advil is. And the patents are 10 years and they expire. And then like the next level company basically copies the exact chemical formula, but they don't have scientific debt to pay off. And that's why generic drugs are so much cheaper. Yeah. I think that for certain countries, like this is like a random idea I just came up with, but based on the Johnson & Johnson stuff, like we should be incentivizing scientific discoveries. We should be incentivizing, and I think in America, especially like the healthcare system is very touchy one, you know, to be like, let's make drugs more expensive. But I think in a country like Canada, where our healthcare is government subsidized, like if I was part of that like task force, I would definitely think about how we can incentivize the new discovery of these interventions.
There are some ways to incentivize it without patents. As a few examples, there's one company out of Toronto, or one group of people out of Toronto, who are developing a drug for a rare children's disease that I forget what it is, but they're open sourcing everything. And the idea is that other scientists with this open source data will like go and work on it and then publish more things that can help them. But they had like a 5-year head start. So they're just assuming like nobody's going to catch up to us. So we're going to open source all of this. Other scientists are going to build off of our research and like make it better. And just assuming that nobody's going to catch up to us, open sourcing has no downside to us. Another example, interesting one, is the polio vaccine. When it was being developed, because polio was like rampant in the US, it was killing a ton of children. It was a really obviously big national concern. And so people started donating to the development of the vaccine, like millions and millions of dollars. Families who had nothing would sell things to send donations to the development of the polio vaccines because people were really, really scared for their children. And so when it was developed, Jonas Salk, I think is his name, who developed the polio vaccine, in one really famous interview, he was like, this vaccine belongs to the people. It was funded by these millions of dollars of donations. Like, there's no way in heck that I'm about to patent this. And so if we can ramp up that kind of public concern, then the idea that a drug can like belong to the people is also possible. So that was just a side note, but small tangent.
A cool example. And the open source company seems like to have a lot of Canadian values, just to like put trust in the people and to trust that they're on a good start. Let's switch gears. I want to hear if nature is real.
Funny that you asked that. It's almost like I've mentioned this before. Okay. To explain the question, I'm studying sustainability at McGill. And when I enrolled in this degree, I did not expect to get so many classes taught to me on the fact that nature is a construct. But here I am, getting taught that over and over and over again. Okay, here's the rundown. It is a very widely accepted idea in academia that nature is a construct. To make it easier to understand, think about wilderness is a construct. Maybe that's easier to grapple with. The idea here is that nature is this pristine, untouched, set aside piece of land that humans have not interacted with. And so then the opposite of nature is culture. So it's this kind of nature-culture dichotomy. So nature is untouched by humans, culture is the opposite. And the reason that it's considered that wilderness or nature is a construct is because essentially there are no pieces of land that are untouched by humans. This is just kind of this idea that we've made up in our heads. A really good example, an illustration of this, is parks in general. The word park actually comes from the Latin word parcius, which means fence. Yes. So parks are not this great, sprawling, natural slice of land, untouched and pristine. It's actually an enclosure of an equally human-created thing. So, for example, the national parks, which were established in the late 1800s in the U.S., when they were going out and seeking these places to enclose, they were not these just like pristine pieces of wilderness that were untouched by humans. There were indigenous people living on there for centuries and centuries who were farming, who were manipulating the land very drastically. And those people were forced out for the creation of these parks. So wilderness is more so this idea that it's untouched and unmanipulated by humans, whereas actually we force those humans out of there to create this illusion. And you can say the same about several types of parks. Yeah, that's the idea of why nature and wilderness is a construct.
Amazing. You are so articulate. That was exceptional. I think that's exceptional. Let's transition, because this is what you're learning. This is the McGill education. This is the 4 years. This is Canada's Harvard.
Harvard of the North. I really want to meet someone from Harvard and be like, oh my God, you go to the McGill of the South? That is so cute. Anyways, I just think it would piss them off.
I think this is a good time. Tell us about the Harvard of the North. What have you learned? What have you experienced? I know you and I have chatted because we're going to be some of the first TKS University graduates.
Hell yeah.
And to make things even more interesting, we're considering post-secondary.
don't say these things in this environment. Illegal.
But I think it's interesting because we're both kind of in these sciencey paths, and science as an institution thrives in these universities. It's different with entrepreneurship. An entrepreneur versus a professor of entrepreneurship, they take very radically different processes. Whereas a scientist versus like someone running a biotech company, they still are in the pursuit of truth. They're in the pursuit of using these resources. They want methodological things. Whereas if you're trying to sell like a SaaS product, you don't care about the abstract and the methodology and like that process. So I think that's like what makes science a very relevant thing to study in university, and sustainability in particular, especially climate change, has some like unscientific takes because the public feels like they're an expert in climate change because they've been outside before. Tell me a little bit about your thoughts on university, maybe providing the valuable takes and how you've crafted, I think from what I've heard from you, a very meaningful educational experience for yourself.
Yeah, I kind of see university as having a few functions for me personally, like how I've experienced it. The first is really similar to what you're saying. It's a way of thinking. Like academia, I think people think they understand how academics think because they understand like the scientific method, which we're taught in grade 8 science or whatever. But like it goes so much deeper than that in just the rigor. And I think that's also a word that you just used. Like as an example, I find it so refreshing. My professors will very seldom give an opinion. I know that sounds like maybe that would be frustrating, especially in the field of sustainability, learning about climate change. But like you said, everybody thinks that they are an expert in this. Even like if you read a news article on climate change, it will usually have a stance. If you read an article in the New York Times about carbon taxes or whatever, the two sides of carbon taxes, and like here's all the information you need to know, it's going to be somebody making a stance, and then people read that article and they walk away and they're like, oh well, actually carbon taxes are bad, or carbon taxes are the savior for like XYZ reason. And like everything in this field is so much more complicated than a 700 word article, and people really feel like they need to have an opinion and that they're qualified to have an opinion in anything in this space. And so it's very, very refreshing to come from a perspective of these people are literally, their whole job is to learn about it and be the most knowledgeable about it. And opinions can be super, super useful when you're trying to like make a decision and drive action. And so some people do need to have opinions. But if your only goal is to learn about it and to be knowledgeable about it, you don't need an opinion. And so I think that is just super refreshing to have people who are so intensely value truth to the point where they feel like forging an opinion, even after years and years of research, is like kind of controversial for just to their own way that they think. They want to be as objective as possible. And that is just like a really, I think, useful way to think about things. And then the other values of university, one is the people. I genuinely have met people that I really, really, really love at McGill, to the point where I would consider moving where they are after university, like not just a romantic partner. Like these are just friends that I want for life. And then the last is like the experience as advertised. It's pretty fun. It's what you'd expect, you know, like you get the university experience. Good time.
Yeah. I think you're one of the most authentic people I know. And I think you've been able to go to university, stay true to yourself, and become a magnet for other people. And also realize the people who like don't work with your magnet. And I think it's totally a superpower that you have. And I'm wondering, can you talk about that like intersection of how do you maintain that authenticity when with a system that is kind of like rigorous and there's a couple of personalities that really thrive? Tell me about that, the process of authenticity.
Yeah, authenticity is hard. And I think I struggled with it a lot when I was in my later teen years, as a lot of people do. I think it's unarguably hardest to be authentic in those teens and early 20s years. It's just a time where you're really trying to figure out who you are. And the hardest part about authenticity, and something that I struggled a lot with, is that by its nature, you can't try really hard to be authentic. But you can try to not be inauthentic. So you can be very conscious of things that you're doing that feel like they're going against who you are or people that you're hanging out with that you're not jiving with. So you can put a lot of active effort into not being inauthentic. And I think that just comes from like checking in very often. But then once you go to the other side, if you want to be somebody who's super authentic, the issue is, yeah, you can't really do that with a lot of effort. But I think what I learned is that you can find the spaces and the groups of people where you can be authentic. And that's just going to be the most meaningful way to find who your authentic self is. Like, it took me 25 and a half years, not an exaggeration, to find a group of people that I wasn't anxious around. And like, you can't be authentic if you're anxious. It's impossible. And so finding those groups of people, those spaces who click with you so you can be authentic, then you can take that data from who you are when you're authentic and try to extrapolate that to other situations. And so it takes a while because you can't like try really hard in every instance to be authentic, but just trying to find the spaces where you're least anxious, feel the most comfortable, I think can teach you a lot.
Do you think there's any prerequisites to doing that?
Self-awareness, for sure. I think self-awareness takes like a lot of effort to build up. It takes a lot of time and a lot of effort. You just have to be willing to constantly check in with yourself and be as least judgmental with yourself as possible when you check in. And that'll take time to develop. It definitely took a lot of time for me to develop. So, yeah.
Yeah. What about confidence? Not as necessarily as a prerequisite to authenticity, but I'm curious how you think about confidence and if it does have an intersection.
Yeah, I used to think a lot about confidence because I was outwardly always very confident and then inwardly always had like so much like a rampant insecurity. And so I was always struggling with like, okay, how do I gain more confidence? How do I get rid of these insecurities? Okay, I think the biggest thing for me for dealing with my insecurities was learning to think about them without panicking while thinking about them, which sounds very simple, but I think I used to, anything that was an insecurity or that I felt like I needed to grow on, I would start thinking about like, okay, how can I address this? But then the thought would just come with so much fear and so much panic about like, what if I fail? And so learning to think about what I'm insecure about without getting freaked out about just thinking about it was like so fundamental. I think also stepping away from people who were actively making those insecurities worse was a very big determiner in kind of dealing with those. If there are are making you just feel shitty, just stop being around those people. That's my advice.
I agree with you. one of the things I'm learning about confidence is to be confident, you have to be willing to take up space and not mm-hmm. take up space. To be confident is to be in control. And you have to be willing to trust yourself. That's why I think self-awareness is part of that confidence. And the example that I think about is someone who has like a cool or interesting friend or like did an interesting experience. Like maybe they met someone famous and they're really loud about it. And it's kind of like, it wouldn't be confident to say, hey, Cassia, do you think I'm cool because I know XYZ person? Do you think I'm cool because I went to this place and this is what I did? Do you think I'm cool because I partied until whatever clock? A confident person doesn't do that. A confident person just like, they have these things and they're in their head and they don't need to ask you, hey, am I cool? It's like, I already think that I'm cool. Whether or not you think I'm cool, that's not a determinant to my confidence. That's just your perception of me. And maybe that's a litmus test that I can use. I don't know. But I think to be self-aware and to be self-sufficient are both very useful determinants to confidence. And then I think at that point, you might as well also be authentic.
What do you mean to be confident is to be in control? I don't know if I agree with that.
I think when you're confident, for example, when you're talking and you're not like yapping, like I think I used to talk a lot and very quickly with a lot of filler words because I thought that's what a confident person did. I thought perceptively I was more confident if I just said a lot of things. And if someone got to hear all my knowledge, because then they know that I've like thought through things and I have stuff going on in my brain and I'm smart and they can like believe in me. But at least what resonated with me, and maybe taking up space is the wrong word to like illustrate the idea, but it's more so like being comfortable with taking that pause and saying, I don't need to be rapid to be thoughtful. That's not actually a corresponding component of having a good thought. In fact, I think it's way better just to say nothing, let everyone else be mysterious, and then have your thing to say. That to me takes a lot more guts than just talking and talking and filling up that space.
Okay, so you mean being confident is having self-control?
Yes.
In that way. Okay. Because I think a lot of people seek control in a way that is like unhealthy. I've kind of noticed that manifesting as anxiety for myself. Even we were talking about food earlier and like how I love to seek out the best food in a city and stuff like that. And sometimes that will give me so much anxiety. Like if thinking about the fact that I have gone to a restaurant that's not good, and then I've wasted this like time and this money on a meal that's not good. And I think the reason that gives me anxiety is actually because I felt like I had all the data at my fingertips to make the right decision and I didn't, which made me feel like I didn't have control. So I think a lot of people seek too much control. I think it's a very like inherent human desire and it's super normal, but that's the reason that I asked.
Yeah, that's interesting. It actually reminds me of making the right decisions, making decisions that matter. I think I've observed in a lot of kind of like high level CEO type people is they don't overthink a lot of decisions. Like, should I go to the gym? It's like, I go to the gym every morning so that I don't have to think about whether or not I should go to the gym and what workout I should do. I hire a trainer or whatever. Or, okay, I'm going to work. I'm not going to care about what I eat for breakfast as long as I can have breakfast in the car so I don't waste time. There's certain decisions that you outsource and there's certain decisions that are really important. But the less you care about those really small decisions, the more energy, the more willpower, the more brain power you have to dedicate towards the decisions that really matter. So maybe I kind of retract and take it as being in control of your emotions to the point where it's like, I'm having a panic attack because my earring is rusty. This is probably not something that matters a lot. Or I'm crying over a bag of pretzels. I don't know why. Cannot allocate. I think I'm getting my period. This is a decision that maybe doesn't need to affect my eye ducts in this like intensity. And I think to be aware of these things, it's like a practicing ground, right? And being able to be like, okay, why do I care that much about what other people think of me in this particular context? If I know that I am capable or hardworking or whatever, I don't need to prove it just to anyone. There's a couple of people where that matters. It's the same thing with respect. A lot of people focus on respecting like politically correct opinions and things that are like very mainstream. It's like, that's going to get most people to respect you. But you know who won't respect you? Scientists, the truth seekers, the people at the top who are really pulling the strings. It's like people in the governments that have billions of dollars to invest in oil pipelines, frankly, don't care about the 16-year-olds that are holding like, I hate pipelines and skipping school. It's like, and sorry to like disempower those people, but I think when you really start to understand the strings of the world, you realize like you're going to lose a lot of respect no matter what you do. And so to be confident is knowing why you're doing something and being in control of that.
Yeah, I getcha. See what you're cool. saying.
All right. Okay. Now, Pila. Tell us about Pila. What was that experience like? And specifically, I'm interested in your take on consumer sustainability.
Okay. Okay. I'm not going to be too, this is not going to be an expose.
No. I wasn't expecting that.
Okay. So Pila, for those who are unfamiliar, you might be familiar with their phone cases. They make compostable phone cases. But recently their big product is Lomi, which you probably have gotten an ad for because they advertise so much. It's a composter that looks like a sexy Apple product that sits on your kitchen counter, and it's electric and it digests your food, and then you can sprinkle your food waste into your plants. That's the idea behind the product. And so I interned for them last summer, moved to Kelowna to do that, and it was a super fun experience. I think the biggest thing with Lomi, and kind of one of the proofs of concepts of the product itself, is that sustainability products can be just like a pure status symbol. Like this thing, it really does look like an Apple product. It's sexy as hell. It's pretty sizable. So like you walk into a kitchen, you notice it. It's like, oh, what's that gadget on your counter? And they're very aware that that's the value that their product brings. And so their customers are people like Kim Kardashian. Like it was in the background of one of the Kardashian episodes last year. Like it's people who want a flashy appliance on their counter to say like, oh, me? Yeah, I know about food waste. Like I value a sustainable earth. And that is totally their target market. And so that's like one of the biggest things with Lomi, is that a lot of the money in like these sustainable products can come from people who are just wanting it as a status symbol. But then having said that, for that to be any sort of impact on the world or do any good, these status symbol products have to be actually effective at driving change. And so, for example, their phone cases, like in my interview with Pila, I said very bluntly, I was like, I am not interested in working on your phone cases. I think that the waste from phone cases is not a substantial issue in the world, whereas food waste is. So I was interested in the composter. And so the status symbol of a Pila phone case, which again is a total symbol of your values to other people, I think that it's effective in sales, but it's not effective in driving any sort of meaningful change. And so at large, my thoughts on sustainable consumer products is that 99.999% of them, if we want a more sustainable earth, should not exist. Like, just stop making more shit. Like, if you want a sustainable product, don't buy a product. That's usually the answer. There are companies, though, like Patagonia, who are like absolutely killing it on the sustainability game. Like, Patagonia rocks. They have had entire ad campaigns that are like, don't buy this. And it's a picture of their product, because their whole campaign is like, our products should last you a lifetime. You buy one and you're done. And like, that is the thesis. And they have been very, very profitable off of that sort of consumer base. And so 99.999% of sustainable brands that you see, it's like, if you want a sustainable product, don't buy a product. This shouldn't exist. We don't need another sustainable bikini company on the market. Like, we just really don't. But then there are a few set of companies that if they actually do the due diligence and they do it really well and they're building a product to last you a long time, that is valuable.
Amazing. So thoughtful. And I think it's still important to understand the way human brains work, because whether or not you're building an amazing product, you still have to sell it to humans to make it adopt. And yeah, that's very important. Okay, last long question, and then we have a rapid fire. this one because it's the TKS podcast. How did you learn about TKS and what's one core memory you have from the program?
I learned about TKS through a friend. I did the SHAD program, if you're familiar. And so my friend did SHAD and then they told me about TKS. So I joined TKS like a few months into the into the year because I called Nadeem and I was like, I'm joining. That's what I said, but that's how I felt. He was like, applications are closed. And I was like, no. And then he was like, make me a video about nuclear reactors by tomorrow and we'll talk. And then I did it. And then I was in. So yeah, that's how I heard about TKS. And a core memory, I think a lot of my core memories are from the Activate year. So the second year of the program where it just really felt like everybody had bonded to such an intense degree. And sometimes we would start sessions with like discomfort challenges and just like laughing at everybody trying to do these challenges in the most supportive way. And really feeling like we were all a family there. Those are definitely core memories, or even just like getting food after sessions and the friendships.
The field trips. Oh, good times. I think those are fun answers. Also, did you know Canada's like very cutting edge on nuclear energy recently? Canada, France, and Romania. Recycling uranium, CANDU reactors is a patented Canadian technology. Anyway, random. Okay, now we're going to do rapid fire. You answer it, you know, quick. Okay, first one. What's something you fear? The ghost on Friday nights at the cottage.
I do fear the ghost at the cottage. I think I'm learning to try to not fear lack of control in small instances.
Love it. Okay. What is a next big thing that you don't think a lot of people are talking about?
Okay. I think this is a very non-traditional TKS answer, but the population of Africa, like, that shit is going to double by 2050. The population of Nigeria is going to be bigger than the United States. And they're going to make up like a quarter of the world population. And I think we need to be tailoring our world systems to account for the population of Africa.
This is a good point.
That's all I'm saying.
Have you read facts on this?
Yeah, I just finished it like a few weeks ago.
So good. I love it. Okay. Next one. Who inspires you most recently?
Lame answer, but Billy Gates. Like, nobody talks about it. That guy, like, kind of cured polio. Anyways.
No, he's so sweet. I like his little videos. So cute. I'm talking, anyway, I'm not trying to belittle him, but he brings me a lot of peace and comfort.
Have you seen the video of him working at Dairy Queen?
No.
Go watch it. Him and Warren Buffett own, like all of Dairy Queen, pretty much. And there's a video of them working a shift at Dairy Queen. It's adorable. Anyways.
Okay. And then you watched Hasan Minhaj and Justin Trudeau. And Obama.
Deal.
Very good. Okay. What is something that you are bad at but love doing?
A lot of things. Cooking, baking, dancing.
I'm not bad singing, at cooking or baking. Vito.
Making Instagram videos about my cooking and baking.
No, those are also good. These are bad answers.
Singing in my car.
Not a test. Do you remember our cupcakes that we made? Like the basil strawberry ones?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. You've improved since then. Anyway, what advice would you give to your 13-year-old self?
I would say, like, I wouldn't have myself change any decisions. Like, go through the same shit, learn from it, but learn to like ride with the emotions. Emotions will come and go. Don't try to hang on to happiness. Don't be scared of sadness. Feel it. You're good.
Cool. Okay, last question. What is something everyone should experience at least once in their life?
I think seeing where food comes from is pretty impactful. Like, even if you're not going to visit a farm, like if you're eating quinoa, Google what that shit looks like when it grows. Like, do you know what quinoa looks like on a plant? Most people don't. Google it. It's insightful. I think it just gives you, it's like a very easy gratitude moment to be like, oh my gosh, this is what my food looks like when it's in the land.
Love it. It's so philosophical. Little small moment, and you can just change the way you feel just by a quick Google.
Anyway. Also, Magnolia Bakery in New York. Go eat their banana pudding and go to Italy and eat some tiramisu. Those are things people should do once in their life.
What about the Milan Starbucks Reserve?
Oh my gosh, go to Starbucks in Milan. If you're in Milan, I hated Milan. The only thing in Milan that I liked was the Starbucks. That was an amazing experience. Go ASAP. ASAP.
And you know what's crazy? Today I've had two conversations about the Milan Starbucks Reserve that was this morning over breakfast and Magnolia. Someone I know is moving to New York and I was like, they're like, what's your recommendation? And I'm like, if you're going to do one thing, you go to Magnolia and you get the banana pudding and you eat it every week.
Okay. Though they're seasonal, strawberry shortcake pudding is better. It's better.
No.
I had it.
How seasonal is it? Like how long will it be?
I think it's a summer thing.
Maybe it'll be like a secret menu item.
Yeah, true. Doubt it, yeah. But maybe.
Anyway, grateful for your time, Cassia. Thanks for chit-chatting. I think this was
thank you,
filled Isabel. With anecdotes.
Filled with anecdotes. Now we have, if anybody wants food recommendations in yes. New York or Montreal.
She's the one to go. You offer much more than just food recommendations, but if someone wanted a really quick asset, it's food recommendations from Cassia.
Yay. Thanks for catching up with us. That was Making It Real by TKS, and I'm your host, Isabella. I hope you have a crazy audacious week, and I will see you next time.